I see the number of participants is still going on up, so let's wait until it gets a little stable, I guess. So hello everyone, I'm Dilma da Silva. I am the Division Director for CCF, Computing and Communication Foundations in SAIS. And here we, SAIS, are delighted to have the opportunity to host Professor Mike Carbin. So Professor Carbin is an Associate Professor of Electrical Engineering and Computer Science at MIT, where he leads the Programming Systems Group. In his work, he aims at improving reliability, performance, energy consumption, and resilience for computer systems using techniques from programming language. We are happy to say that Professor Carbin has received an NSF Career Award, Islam Foundation Research Award, MIT Frank Pancake Award for Excellence in Graduate Advising. His work has been recognized in so many forums, but one of those, you know, best paper awards for Uppsala, ICLR, and ICFP. And also it was highlighted in the communications of ACM. He got his undergrad in computer science from Stanford in 2006, and then SMN and a PhD in electrical and computer science from MIT. He then went to Microsoft Research, where he worked with deep learning systems from 2014 to 2018. So we are very pleased to have you here, Professor Carbin, Mike, and go ahead. And we are looking forward to learning all about programming uncertainty and the relationship between them.
Great. Thank you so much for that generous introduction. So yeah, so today I'm going to talk about, I guess, some work that I've been working on since graduate school, I guess coming on almost 15 years now. And you know, the flavor it has changed over the years as our computing systems have changed over the years. I mean, just thinking about the past few months of what's going on with, you know, ChatGPT and GPT-4 and just the new ways of thinking about software. It seems quite phantasmical in some ways. But for a long time, it's sort of been what I've been expecting in some ways, because what I think and the way I think about the world and where computation is going is that every single computation that we're dealing with in programming now, or many of the very interesting and emerging computations that we're thinking about, are what I'd call uncertain computations. And so let me try to explain that. And over the course of this talk, I'll try to explain this, give some examples, and also sort of organize how we might think about the future of software and the important problems that we might need to be working on. So what is an uncertain computation? Well, the way I like to explain this these days is by looking at this cartoon diagram on the computing stack. And the way I came to this explanation was I was teaching a computer systems engineering class several years ago now. We were talking with students about basically trust, you know, your trusted computer. What parts of your system do you trust to be reliable? You know, perhaps error-free or secure, you know, what definitions? And we were going through levels of the stack. You know, we started up at applications, and the students said, oh, applications, libraries, can't trust those. You know, I write code, I write applications, they have bugs in them. So these things are not correct. Now, compiler and runtime system, so a layer lower than that, you know, it's not necessarily so obvious to everyone that there are bugs that we need to deal with at those systems, but there's a long history of work, you know, in my community, the programming community broadly, and of course supported wonderfully by NSF, on actually identifying bugs in these types of systems and reading them. You know, how can we actually do secure computation in a way? Now, below that, operating systems, you know, I think all of us have had the unfortunate experience of dealing with operating system bug, using Windows, even Mac, any of these things. But where things got interesting, you know, I was talking to the students, I asked them about hardware systems, and he said, oh no, hardware, that's great. You know, and this was before, you know, perhaps, you know, Spectre and Meltdown, and more security focus that perhaps we're seeing more broadly in the community around hardware security. But these, again, were undergraduate students. And they said, yes, you know, if I have some instruction, it's 1 + 1, then I'm going to get 2 as the answer. And I unfortunately had to tell them that no, that's not always the case. And so this came as a shock and as a surprise, and sometimes comes from a shock and surprise to people who don't really think about these issues. But in fact, now you right now, you could go on the machine that you're sitting right now and go to Intel's website and find the errata for whichever processor, you know, is sitting in your machine right now. Here's one from, you know, a few years ago. And what it's going to tell you are actually all the bugs, all the errors that may happen in, while executing programs or software on your system. Now, some of these may be rather benign. So this first one at the top, cache performance monitoring events may be accurate. Unless you're doing low-level performance engineering, maybe this isn't something that is going to affect your day-to-day too much. But this one below here at the bottom, this is a little bit more pernicious. So it says processor may hang or cause unpredictable behavior. And really, unpredictable system behavior here, what it means is that your system can return arbitrarily incorrect results at some times. And this is not just, you know, in theory. It's in very, very rare circumstances, but this actually shows up in practice. Where if you're a consumer and you're really hammering on your machine, you know, prosumer level, really doing extensive computations, you can see these types of errors actually show up in corrupt your computations. Now, if you go up another level and think about large, massive organizations that are running supercomputer data set on number jobs, these types of errors actually are a primary concern, a first order concern in the design of these systems. Because you can see that even within the course of a single day, you're very likely to see some sort of corruption inside of your computation. And this is because if you look at a large distributed system, wow, the probability that, let's say, one processor encounters some sort of issue as it's executing may be very small. If you take a large distributed computation, remember, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of cores, the probability that one gets something wrong actually becomes much higher, much, much higher. And we started to see more attention. There's been a long-held focus, actually, in the research community of thinking about these sorts of issues. We're starting to see these, again, reemerge. The different flavor and different names from research that we've been seeing coming out of Google and Facebook in the last couple of years. So how do we cope with this type of problem in practice? And the type of errors I want to talk about here are transient errors, non-deterministic errors, in the sense that if I have a computation and I run it once and it encounters an error, if I start over and run that exact same computation again on that same machine, with high probability, I'm going to get the correct answer. Right? So these are non-deterministic. These are not permanent errors. We're always going to get an incorrect result. Well, in this instance, classically, what we've seen is people use something like replication, right? So there's been a long history of essentially taking a computation that I might have, and I duplicate it. I ran it twice. I check to see if the results agree. The results disagree. Then I'm going to go ahead and run it again. I keep running it and running it until I get the right result. And of course, there's some specific restrictions on the types of errors and frequency of errors in which this is a sensible approach. This has been a classic approach, and so classic that going back in the computing literature, you can find that the first time this really came into computing was von Neumann. We were trying to construct reliable computations from these unreliable components. And what was very interesting at that time is where if you go read this paper, it's actually these unreliable components look a lot like neural networks. And I guess I'll come back to that. Because I think it's reminiscent of, again, these types of concerns that we're dealing with in model and software, where things like neural networks are starting to become part and parcel of the way that we're architecting our system. So now, replication, classic strategy for doing this. But I want to encourage us to think differently about this problem, particularly how might we solve this otherwise? Well, one alternative approach here is, what if we just let errors happen? Right. Instead of trying to correct errors, let's just let them happen. Let's just let the system process through them. And what could go wrong? Well, let's explore this, right? I'm sure, you know, if someone said this to you, you've probably got in your mind all these horrible ways in which this can go wrong. But I want to show an example to you. And this example here is a very simple method for solving systems of linear equations called the Jacobi method. And you don't need to understand this program at all. But I do want to highlight a few specific features of this. So one, this is an iterative algorithm. So you can see there's this while loop where this program is going to run until it converges after some number of steps. So that's the first one. The other thing I want to highlight are these operations in red. So these are operations where I want to show you what happens if we inject errors into these operations and let these errors happen. We let these errors, let these operations be corrupted and let them compute on and go on. And see what happens with the computation. So this is what happens. So here is an illustration of the Jacobi method executing over some number of iterations. So iterations on the x-axis. Y, what we're going to have is the difference between our current yes, it's a solution to the system of linear equations and in the actual solution. Right? And so this blue line is if I just run the computation with no errors. And we see this nice convergent behavior over time, which is very nice. Now, this red line here is what happened if we let errors happen. And in particular, we're going to inject errors here on iteration 10,000. And so what we see here is initially there's quite a significant leap up, right, in error from where we were before. And in fact, it looks like we've lost nearly 5,500 or 6,000 iterations of progress by encountering this error. However, if we actually let this computation continue running out, what we see is that we actually add only 2.6% more iterations until we converge to an equally accurate result. So this is interesting. This is interesting because now it gives us another strategy for thinking about dealing with these types of errors, right? So on one hand, we can do something like replication. And so replication, you might think this is going to be horribly expensive. And in some cases, it really is. But if you scour through the literature and there are very clever tricks for compilation and hardware support, you can find that maybe you can get this down to 50%. Right? I mean, this at least in latency, energy overhead, all these other things, there are other measures that you may need to keep in fact. But conceptually, 50% overhead when we're thinking about time to execution. Now, approximation, on the other hand, what this gives us is instead 2.6% overhead. But the difference, now the difference here and the crux is that our intermediate results or our results in general may differ from what we intended them to be by some epsilon. And so this epsilon is important. So when I think about uncertain computations, what I think about are computations where we've composed the software system and somewhere along the way, or maybe even at the output, results are being computed to some imprecision or inaccuracy, right? And classically, as computer scientists, we have this very discrete view of the world. We don't necessarily think about these things. But of course, if we talk to our friends in numerical analysis or scientific computing, this is something they think about all the time. And over the course of time, what I found through my research is if we can move towards software systems where this epsilon is more explicit, we get new opportunities. Right? And so we're seeing one right here with approximation, where if we know about this epsilon, we can reason about this epsilon, perhaps we can build new systems that are more efficient and tolerant of things like hardware errors. And I think this is critically important as we're thinking forward as a community of how computing is going to evolve, because this type of uncertainty is now absolutely everywhere. So it's coming up from below, from our hardware systems. We already see this with things like errors that are happening in our hardware systems. But even more, you think about the trajectory of machine learning systems. They're moving towards reduced precision systems, where we're going to have approximation of numerical computations that we're doing. We're seeing very emerging computations in stochastic or analog or neuromorphic computing or even quantum computing, where there really are suddenly these fundamentally probabilistic or uncertain computational substrates that we can use or need to use, where the trade-off is we can get much more efficient or much more capable systems, but it's unavoidable that we now need to think about this epsilon. The other way this is coming up is from the application, or more specifically, thinking about the environment. The fact that we're building these applications that are trying to reach out and model a fundamentally uncertain physical world, right? So take, for example, this computer vision example here, or something like object detection. The goal of these types of systems is to try to actually identify the objects or the locations and positions and bounding boxes around objects that we have in the stream. And unfortunately, this system only has noisy access, right, to this physical world, right? This environment is only partially observable. The data that we're getting back from sensors is noisy, and the models that we're using to construct these types of bounding boxes in essence are fundamentally only correct with some sort of probability, because they're typically approximations. And as well, moving across to other applications of machine learning, image processing, computer vision, quantum, again, we have fundamentally applications themselves where this epsilon is now important. So uncertainty, these epsilons are starting to show up everywhere in our computing stack. Again, coming from below, coming from above. And this is interesting. It's amazing. It's giving us new capabilities. We're able to build software systems that perhaps we couldn't even build before. Right, thinking about what neural networks are really able to do these days and processing on uncertain sensor data that's coming in. We're getting very interesting opportunities for performance. I'm thinking about, again, what happened with approximate computing or this approximation opportunity I talked about a few slides ago. And of course, resilience as well, resilience to errors. You know, things go wrong and they're only epsilon wrong, can we figure out a way to still work through those types of errors? But there's a fundamental research question here, which is, well, how do we build software this way? How can we productively build software that has all the nice properties that we think about, things like modularity and compositionality and things that we can reason about in the presence of these epsilons? Because this is not how we formally or have traditionally constructed software. It hasn't been the main focus of computer science. Again, we've been thinking about deterministic and discrete objects. So that brings me essentially to, well, really the subject of today's talk, and really what I've been doing over the years of thinking about ways of building software in this new reality from programming methodologies. How do we think about these new emerging software systems that are now mixed between classical code, neural networks, and now with things like ChatGPT, GPT-4, all the other models that are out there, perhaps natural language, but there's really interesting compositions where ultimately, at the end of the day, even what these computations do, we only know what some of these computations do up to some epsilon, perhaps. Moving beyond that, there are fundamental questions in semantics. So many of these computations now are real valued, they're non-deterministic, they're probabilistic. As I had said before, this is not where computer science has spent most of its time, right? And instead, we need to fundamentally think about what are the semantics of programs that actually execute with these types of data types, because it is actually fundamentally different. Beneath that, we need to think about, how do we represent things like real numbers, non-determinism, probability? How do we compute? What are efficient representations of these types of data types, so that we can compute on them productively in these types of applications? And then finally, reasoning. Once I have this software system, how do I actually now reason about what sort of guarantees that I can get from this? Can I actually prove that with reasonable probability, it's going to satisfy some specification that I have in my mind? Or perhaps, is it going to be epsilon close to a specification that I have in mind? So today, what I want to do is I want to talk to maybe just a couple of these, but I'm going to motivate this, you know, on how I've been seeing this, how I've gone about looking at this problem from a really specific application of thinking about, how do we build software sort of in this domain? And let's say these programming methodologies that are very rich and expressive in the sense that we get neural networks and perhaps other specific techniques, really to solve a classic problem of mine, one of my great problems in compilation. You know, how can we build new compilers that incorporate learning to tackle the fact that now our underlying hardware systems are actually very uncertain, and we need very expressive models, rich learned models of the behavior. So I'm going to do that and then use that as an example, really, to concretize a few of the opportunities that I see in this space. So, to the core, a compiler. So this is an incredibly simplified perspective of compiler. I know we have a broad audience here. For some of you, you probably spend time hacking on compiler. I try to write a compiler every year. It's sort of my therapy. I really love writing compiler. But for many of you, this is perhaps a reasonably simple diagram, in the sense that I have source code, C++, C, Java, something coming in on one end into the system. And then on the other side, I'm going to get machine code. And of course, this can be broken out into finer and finer granularities if you actually know how these systems are composed. There's oftentimes a front end going from source code to an intermediate representation, and then from that intermediate representation, then down to the machine code itself. Now, where I want to focus my attention is mostly on this back end, where we have this rich intermediate representation that represents the program, and we're figuring out, how do we take that and really map it onto the machine? And so this problem, this optimization problem, we can think of as follows. So here is a simple example, right, where I have this code here in the middle where I've got three little instructions. And my goal here, you know, one particular goal here that you can have in a backend is we want to figure out what's the optimal ordering of these instructions such that I can get the best performance on the underlying machine. Now, so this ordering, what is an ordering? Well, it's going to be some permutation of the instructions that I have. And this is going to give us essentially a transformation space. So there's some space of valid transformations I can have of this particular code. And we can represent that here as this DAG that I'm showing here. But what this is representing is the data dependencies, right? Obviously, I can't compute C until I've computed A and B. So A and B need to precede C in any particular ordering that I have of this computation that I'm ultimately going to generate. So any topological sort through this graph is actually a valid ordering that I'm going to have of a computation. So that's my transformation space. The next critical component here is I'm going to have something that's called a performance model. So I want to take any permutation of these instructions and then be able to predict what the underlying performance is going to be, right, on the actual machine. And oftentimes what I want to be able to predict is because I want to be able to explore broadly in this transformation space. This transformation space may be much larger than just, you know, the two options that we see here. Rather, it could be thousands, more than thousands, exponentially many, even in the size of the program. And with that in mind, we want efficient ways to be able to search this rather than actually trying to run perhaps a potentially expensive computation on an underlying machine, right? So our performance model is here to actually help us out with that. So for example, here are some examples where a performance model may say, okay, the cost of this one is going to be 3. This first one, the cost of the second one is going to be 2. So now with that performance model in hand, now we can search. There's a methodology for trying to search, efficiently search these types of spaces. And this particular instance, we're going to go ahead and choose this one with cost 2, which we think is going to be more efficient. So this compiler backend, this is in some sense the basic strategy that we have. Where now a key critical component for getting this work is the underlying performance model. How do we understand, how do we model what the machine is doing beneath us so that our compiler can make effective search decisions and how to generate code? Now, this performance modeling problem has always been a very tricky problem, but it's becoming even more tricky in modern computing because not only are we thinking about, let's say, our traditional, you know, classic processor, we're starting to get these very heterogeneous systems. They're spanning many different chips of very divergent styles, right? Some are very efficient in particular dimensions for particular computations. Some you really want to use for very expensive computations, you know, such as machine learning. And we really want to be able to map essentially an application and parts of that application down to each of the individual chips that I may have available inside of my system. And so this sort of heterogeneous mapping problem is a hard problem, and it's become increasingly hard. And so in the systems communities, there is just this fundamentally hard systems challenge that many people in the community at this point are trying to tackle, which is we want to take our program, we're going to have some sort of hardware specification of all the components that we may have, the sea of components that we may have down here at the bottom that we may be targeting, and we need a performance model. And our compiler is supposed to then, you know, magically come in, navigate this space, and generate code that appropriately targets machines below. Now, this is becoming increasingly harder, partly because what have I talked about before, in the sense that each of these components, each of these chips, each of these machine components may have a different behavioral model, right? Now, again, we're moving away from these traditional models of computation where I have single input going into my processor and get a single input that's coming out. And instead, I need to think about emerging models of computation where single inputs may now be turning into distributions of inputs. And individual devices may have very different distributions of inputs. And so now, if I really want to think about the emerging systems challenge, I need to broaden that to now include this behavioral model. And so given the complexity of these and the fact that really the only effective way that we can measure the true behavior and performance of the machines is often through observations, is actually by running things in observations. This in essence has for a long time been viewed as a learning problem and is increasingly so being viewed as a learning problem, something where we're starting to see very effective techniques for applying that. Right. So what I wanna talk about today is a little bit of our work that we've been done on the performance modeling side of using machine learning to build these performance models, right? And again, with an eye for concretizing exactly how these sorts of exotic software systems are starting to be developed. Again, being motivated by the fact that, well, learning may be one of the most effective ways to capture the underlying uncertainty, the exact behavior of the underlying machine. And therefore, if we incorporate learning, we can get a more effective software system. So performance modeling. So we already got a little peek preview of this before, a few slides ago. And as I mentioned, this is critical for compilation, but also other areas of performance engineering, debugging. But essentially what this is going to take is some piece of code, let's say x86 basic blocks. This is the domain in which we've actually validated some of our results. And we're going to throw it into a performance model, and it's going to give us a number, a cost. And here, in this case, what we are looking at is throughput. So throughput of sequence of instructions is essentially, if I were to think about taking this code and just unrolling it all the way, right? And then processing it. It is in the steady state of executing that. How many cycles does it take to execute essentially that basic block, an iteration of that basic block? And again, think about the steady state unrolled and averaged off across perhaps an, you know, an infinite number of iterations. And you know, the lower this cost, the fewer cycles it takes, the better or the faster I can execute that code. Now, this problem is hard. I've alluded to it's hard, and I want to give you some more evidence that it's hard and go through some examples here. But the reason it's hard is because this is a very complicated device or system that we're trying to characterize. So if you look at your modern microprocessor, what you're going to see is a very sophisticated type of system. And if you're building a performance model here, an accurate performance model, you need to figure out or come up with some effective model of many of the components of this system, right? Where instructions are coming in this front end. You know, they're being fetched, they're being decoded, they're being scheduled, they're being actually executed. There's also, of course, a whole memory subsystem that has to be dealt with, right? And if you actually, in principle, want to model this, you need to come up with essentially some model of the behavior of all these individual components, how they work, how they fit together, and of course, the appropriate cost associated with each one of these. Now, what makes this more challenging is while we have these sort of cartoon diagrams, and there's some fidelity that we have in these diagrams, the reality is that the true access that you're going to have to one of these machines is going to look like this, right? And that's because we don't have a full specification. We do have some help. So the Intel manual, right? And so when I give this part of a talk, you know, in person, there's usually someone that sees the Intel manual slides and sort of puts their head down and starts crying, weeping because they've spent endless hours reading through this documentation trying to figure out what exactly your processor is trying to do. But it's a beast. It's a beast. It documents many, many aspects of the architecture. Instruction specifications, optimizations, CPU parameters, things that can help you towards the end of building, if not a mental performance model, an actual physical performance model. And again, this is filled. So it's filled with things like these sorts of instruction tables. But again, this is not perfect. Now, if you actually look at these instruction tables and you go through, what you start to see are footnotes like this. So these instruction tables are telling you various aspects of the latency of throughput instructions on a given machine. But if you start to dig in here, you'll see comments like this: all tables in this appendix are estimates, right? Actual performance of these instructions, right, can range from somewhat faster to significantly faster. So what it means is, though you're getting, again, a peak, you're not getting a full peak. And partly because this is a very hard problem. These are very complicated systems, and to Intel's credit, they're trying to do a very reasonable job of trying to expose some sort of specification that people can work with. But this abstraction, this single instruction abstraction with these latencies and throughput isn't a complete abstraction. It's very hard to try to deliver this abstraction. So what this means is, if someone's sitting down trying to build this performance model, oftentimes, of course, they'll be consulting these tables, but within the full complexity of this process, what they'll do is they'll start to make simplifications, especially when you're thinking about compilation rather than, you know, other areas of research where you need higher fidelity performance models. And so what they do is they abstract. They'll choose a smaller subset of these components, make some assumptions about their behaviors, right? And then set some parameters based on what they found, and they're going to get this. And so now your modern performance model, at least as represented in something like your modern compiler, LLVM, is going to look something like this, very simplified version of the reality that we have. Now, as an example here, just to see how hard this is, so I'm going to give it you a test. No, I don't expect anyone to actually know this. We're going to walk through this one. So here's an example. And that is, how many X cycles does it take to compute 100 iterations of this following instruction? Now, I don't expect you to understand this instruction, but we'll go ahead, look at the Intel manual, and we'll go ahead and decode this instruction. So if I go and look at this page in the Intel manual, what I'll find is, aha, this is actually, it's a vector instruction, but what it's doing is essentially a bitwise logical XOR of these registers. So I can rewrite this. And now I get something that's maybe a little bit more interpretable to your average computer scientist, where I've got some register R1, and I'm going to store into it the value of R1 XOR with R1. All right, and now I can start to try to figure out a performance model. I can go to another part of the Intel manual and look up the latency and the throughput for this instruction. Again, similar to those tables that we saw a few slides ago. So if I go and look here, what I'm gonna find is that this instruction has a latency of 1. So that what that means is it's gonna take 1 cycle The abstraction is it's going to take one cycle for the processor to execute this instruction. And then it has a throughput of 0.33, or really 1/3. And the way to think about this is a processor can execute 3 concurrent instances of this instruction at the same time, provided there are no data dependencies between that. So you can execute 3 of these at the same time. And these are the numbers we're going to find. So now with this information, we can take a first crack at figuring out, you know, what is it, how many cycles will it take to compute 100 iterations, right, of this instruction? All right. I'll give you a moment. Okay. There are a wide variety of different answers when I try to do this in person. All of them actually pretty good, because this is a weird one. So the first one, a very reasonable one here, is actually the answer that you would get from LLVM's performance model as of several years ago when we were doing this work. And then after they saw our work, they changed the performance model. But this is the answer they get, 100 cycles. And the reason why you would think that is because, well, I've got this instruction here. It takes one cycle. And moreover, this instruction reads from R1 and then writes to R1, right? I can't begin executing my next instruction, right? Unless I've completed executing the previous instruction, you know, if they're reading and writing from that same data point, right? So this is a very reasonable thing to start with, just by looking at the data dependencies, right? So R1 is going to flow in R1. So of course, this is going to take 100 cycles because each instruction takes one cycle to execute. And there's a data dependency between. All right. Now, there's a trick here, right? So if you look at this a little bit more carefully, or perhaps you're familiar with your bit twiddling and bit vector arithmetic, what you'll see is that, well, this isn't really this instruction. This is really this instruction. I'm setting R1 to 0. And like, okay, that's interesting. Like, why? This is a cool optimization. Like, I feel like my compiler should generate that. Well, not only might a compiler try to generate that, your processor will actually dynamically identify this and rewrite the instructions. So if you go and actually point and hunt around through the Intel manual, you'll find that there are 0 idioms, but the processor itself has been manually optimized to find these sorts of 0 idioms. And if you go and find this list, you'll see our instruction that we have, that's our mnemonic that we were looking with before we rewrote it to be simpler. And what we'll find is the processor finds all instances of these 0 idioms and they get removed and they have no execution latency. And so, great, suddenly our latency goes to 0. And now we can instead start thinking about throughput, right? There's no data dependency here. And throughput here said we can execute 3 at a time. So what that means is now, well, maybe this is gonna be 33 cycles. All right, that's gonna be good. But if you do some more poking and you actually go and measure this, what you end up with is 25 cycles. Or if you use Intel's proprietary performance model, performance analysis tool, IACA, that they had released at the time, you see this 25 cycles. And then you start to wonder, what's going on here? And in fact, what eventually ends up happening is once you go through this renaming process, you're no longer even bottlenecked by these instruction specifications, and instead you become bottlenecked by the front end, which can actually do 4 instructions per cycle, and so you get an entirely different number ultimately once you measure this. So this is hard because how do we go from what Intel gave us, that's this very reasonable instruction specification, which, you know, an actual production compiler was using because this was the process that they used, to the actual measured performance, right? Or the proprietary performance where Intel has worked in all the optimizations and smarts. Like, how can we cobble together all this documentation, our understanding and measurements to get there? Well, in practice, what people do is they do this. They will build their simplified performance model. They'll stack that against their actual processor. They'll get a data set of examples. They'll pass that through both, compare the difference, see where they're wrong, and then refine, right? And this, by and large, if you go and look through the development process, you know, of many of these certainly open source performance models, you'll see this iterative refinement process. And so in the process, when we were doing this research at the time, we sort of looked at this and said, this looks an awful lot like machine learning, right? I've got a data set, I've got labels. There's some sort of model I'm trying to tune. I can look at the difference and I'm refining my model. And so why don't we just go ahead and replace that with a neural network? Let's just see what happens. And so in some work called iThemal, this is exactly what we did, right? Where we came up with a neural network. We built a data set, a very extensive data set at the time, that had some specific invariants designed to capture invariants that we have for these performance models, things like no cache misses, preemptions. It's very simplified setting, not the full model setting. But this is, in fact, how systems like LLVM-CA, they actually model themselves. And then, of course, we get a comprehensive data set. And so we went and ran this, and we found that we can actually, using this technique, just raw neural networks, build a system that had half of the error of LLVM and Intel's AKA, you know, at that time. And so this was great. This was an amazing success. I think this was one of the first papers really out there, at least in the modern era, to be able to demonstrate that we could scale up this type of deep learning to actually target this type of problem. And so iThemal, there are some details to its architecture. I don't really want to focus on those too much. There's some novelties, but I think the most important part here is really that it's entirely learned representation. So unlike previous work in incorporating machine learning into these types of performing modeling situations, what iThemal did is it takes text, tokenized text, and predicts a number. There's no featureization of the code. We don't need to extract data dependencies, all these sorts of things, nothing, right? Learned representations has been the interest and fare of, let's say, the past 10 years of modern deep learning, which is that we can move away from explicit featureization of our data and have these incredibly capable systems come in and learn purely from inputs or text to get a very effective result. And so if you look at iThemal, if you come back, this example that we have, iThemal ends up getting pretty close to this measured version. So it actually is able to figure out this optimization that is happening beneath the scenes by the processor that's been detailed purely from data, right? Purely from measured data. Now, so iThemal, this has been great. It's taken on our standard methodology, replaced it with a neural network, but not all is perfect, right? Because one benefit of your traditional performance model is you can, in principle, understand what's happening. These performance models, oftentimes, when they're written, they sort of have a trace. There's some sort of explanation. There's a simulation that you can read off that models individual stages of the processor that gives you a hypothesis on how the system believes the underlying processor is actually behaving. And so this can be very helpful for things like performance debugging. I'm really trying to figure out, how do I optimize my system, change my code based on the observations that I'm seeing from the simulation? So this lack of interpretability motivated us to think a little bit differently here. Once we had iThemal, which was, can we maybe try to combine the best of both worlds, where instead of entirely throwing out our analytical model and replacing with a neural network, maybe what we can do is combine them both. More of a neural symbolic approach. And so in the next line of work called DiffTune, we did exactly that. And the way that we started out is we said, okay, let's look at this LLVM MCA simulator that we have, which had a very detailed simulation pipeline, but unfortunately had some wrong intuition on what was actually going on, right? In particular, it's parameterized. It's parameterized by these sorts of numbers that we're seeing down here at the bottom. And it has its own hypothesis on what these numbers are. And we said, could we use machine learning to figure out better sets of parameters to then plug into LLVM-CA to therefore get better accuracy, but still be able to interpret essentially a trace of the behavior of the underlying system. So we dug into LLVM-CA. And like I said, it's a fairly detailed simulation. Again, this isn't going to be, architecture level research psychoactive simulation, but this is reasonable enough as is used inside of a compiler to be able to validate various scheduling-based optimizations that are going on inside the backend of the compiler. Now, LLVM-MCA is not small. It's not super massive, but not small. It's about 10,000 lines of C++. But where it does become big is it has about 11,000 integer-valued parameters that determine its behavior. And so this is the challenge. And these parameters come from it trying to plug in the pieces of this model that it has, right? So there's a dispatcher, right? which essentially is a very simplified model of a front end. Instructions coming in, at what rate do they get decoded and dispatched up to the rest of the processing pipeline? And there's a single parameter. How many instructions can be dispatched per cycle? There's also a reorder buffer, right? So it's also modeling out of order execution. And there's a size of the reorder buffer, right? There's some number of instructions that it has. But where things start to get more complicated is that it starts to have per instruction parameters, such as these write latency and read advice and read advance cycles, right? Which is, if I have instruction and, for example, it has a write, how soon can that computation be made available to a subsequent instruction before it actually really needs to be fully retired, right? And as well, there are execution units with things like port maps. I don't expect everyone really to understand all the details in here, but the real primary point here is that every single one of these individual components can have some manner of parameters, some of them global, some of them being very specific to the individual instructions that we have. We're all in told together, we end up with 11,000 parameters, where the LLVM-CA developers, unfortunately, the way they do this is how we've talked about, spending a lot of time looking at design documents and also doing some measurement and refining. So with our system DiffTune, when we wanted to apply learning, we thought about this really as an optimization problem, where the way we can think about this is I have some simulator, right? So F is my simulator here, right? It has some set of parameters theta, and on a given input, X, it's going to produce a prediction, right? Some model of the performance of that particular input, meaning a basic block, right? How many cycles is it going to take? Now, the optimization problem is, well, if I have a data set, right? Can I essentially minimize or find the best set of parameters that minimize the discrepancy between this prediction that I have and a true measured ground truth prediction that I have for the data set? So nothing fancy here, right? This is just optimization problem specification of thinking about how can we optimize the simulator, where it's indexed again by about these 11,000 parameters, which together give us an absolutely massive number of possible configurations. So this problem, as it's posed, is unfortunately horribly intractable. Using search or stochastic search, as we validated by using other tools available in the technique, such as OpenTuner, available in the community, such as OpenTuner, these existing tools that we have just simply do not scale to this type of problem. So what we said is perhaps we can build a surrogate optimization problem. And so the key thing here is that this is exactly the same optimization problem, except we have an F hat here, where the idea is F hat is going to be a surrogate. It's going to be a neural network that approximates the behavior of the simulator, you know, conditioned on a set of parameters, right? So given some set of parameters theta, you know, this surrogate is going to intuit what our simulator would do given those parameters theta, right? And the reason why we did this and with this approach is because now it's going to allow us to do gradient-based optimization. What we can do is now take gradients with respect to these parameters, essentially just gradient descent to try to figure out if we can find effective parameters that are going to minimize this problem that we have. And just to put this like pictorially, what we're trying to do here is this is sort of a visualization of an instruction that we're going to have inside of our architecture, where there's a parameter that we can control, particularly the dispatch width, right? And this parameter of LLMCA, we can look at the timing or the latency of this particular, we look at the throughput of this particular instruction as a function of this parameter. And so what we can see is LLVMCA, what it's gonna do is for each individual discrete point of this parameter, it will have a prediction. Now, again, the problem is this is going to be essentially a discrete optimization. And even using zeroth order methods, we were unable to find effective ways to navigate this space. But if we build a surrogate, what the surrogate can do is now give us a smooth interpolation once trained between all of these points. Right? And so now what it allows us to do is try to find and navigate through this curve to identify the exact timing, right, where this is the ground truth timing that we're going to have for this instruction, and this is going to intersect roughly between here and here, And this is going to give us some understanding of what this parameter should be, which we can now find via gradient descent. So this is our surrogate optimization problem. We're going to have this F hat instead of our traditional simulator, our discrete simulator, which is otherwise not differentiable. This is a highly discrete computation that has not only discrete integers that it's operating at, but very many discrete data structures that it's using to organize the simulation. So this neural network gives us now a very differentiable surrogate of this otherwise discrete computation. Now, where does the surrogate come from? Well, what we did is we use ithamol. So we used our previous approach. Ithamol changed it ever so slightly so it can be conditioned on a set of parameters, but used a variant of ithamol architecture to then mimic the behavior of our surrogate. So now this is going to introduce a surrogate learning problem where our goal here is now to find F hat. Again, over this data set that we're going to have, this is a data set we're using for learning, slightly different, enumerating over this data set, over parameters and also examples, what we want to do is minimize the difference between our surrogate here and our actual simulator. So we are training our surrogate to exactly mimic, in the best that it can, the behavior of our simulator itself over a wide variety of different parameter settings. So the results here are actually quite great. So compared to OpenTuner, again, using essentially at that time, the state of the art that we had for doing zeroth order methods, they use a wide portfolio of random search techniques and zeroth order methods to actually try to find solutions to tuning problems for systems. Right? And so on the left here, what we've got is the mean absolute percentage error. So lower is going to be better here. And here, this is going to be validated on various different microarchitectures that we're going to have from Intel and also AMD. And so what we see is OpenTuner, by far, unsuccessful in this problem. Our expert, so these were the default expert parameters that had been provided from us and had been tuned manually over the years through this open source effort. And then finally, we had DiffTune, which came in essentially all instances with either competitive or better accuracy. And this is, again, learned entirely from data. So we loop back to our example again. You know, LLVM, where we started at, was 100. We had ithamol, which did a great job of really getting much closer to the true measured performance and even, again, expert modeled, proprietary expert model performance. And then DiffTune comes in at 27. So it's actually able to come in and get very close to our ithamol result. But again, recovering the interpretability now of LLVM in the sense that we can get full trace of what we anticipate or what LLVM MCA hallucinates or believes is the underlying execution behavior of a piece of code on an online machine. So now, ithamol, DiffTune, and even efforts that we've had continuing on from there have been tackling this performance modeling problem, learning. We've had some work in behavioral modeling coming from a variety of different directions, you know, oftentimes from our approximate computing work. I'm not going to talk about that there. But we've also made efforts in the past several years to think differently about even learning the compiler, right? Can the compiler itself, can it now take this different or this these learned performance models, these learned behavioral models? And really now, can we think about automatically generating a compiler or automatically generating a backend? Can we do all of this really from first principles from data without necessarily the manual process that we normally have here? Right? And there's been a very vibrant community standing up doing work in this space right now, where there is by and large a grand challenge here of automatically synthesizing a compiler from data and, of course, a hardware correctness specification. Now, but what I want to highlight here again is the process that we went through. So we had this standard development methodology for performance modeling. We then realized that what we're trying to do is it's a modeling problem, right? And in particular, this is we're trying to model uncertainty. We have some fundamental uncertainty about this hardware substrate and neural networks. In the last decade or so have emerged as a very effective technique for modeling uncertainty. So that's how we moved to ithamol. Now, of course, with ithamol, we lacked now the interpretability of understanding our system. While this may be great, while it may be great in performance in terms of how well the model matches reality, it's unfortunately not necessarily usable for all circumstances because in many circumstances, we do want to understand what our system is doing. And so with that, we moved to DiffTune, which is now this neurosymbolic approach. Now, of course, if you've been paying, I imagine you've been paying attention to ChatGPT and everything that's been going on in the world for the past few months, if not years. But you can see now this trend of what we have with software. Again, where we were before, neural networks, neurosymbolic combinations of neural networks and traditionally written components. And now, really a future of software that may even include large language models, instances where our program is now going to be half code, half trained neural networks, or not half, a third code, third trained neural networks, and maybe another third of just English, right? You're really starting to see people start to report these very strange experiences of, yeah, my program is about half code and half English, meaning prompts for large language model. And this is a very weird future, right? But I personally think this future was inevitable. This is where we've been moving towards for some number of years. Again, as I've said before, uncertainty has been creeping in downwards from our environment, thinking about how we're deploying systems in all these new places where we're trying to get them to model uncertainty, and machine learning has finally emerged as an effective way to model uncertainty, really end to end, right? Large-scale differentiable systems have really been, you know, a huge boom for thinking about how to address many of these types of problems. And we're seeing that as well with things like IFMOL and DIFF2. Coming up below, as I've talked about, right? This is the other case where we're seeing uncertainty. Now with DIFF2, yeah, with IFMOL and DIFF2, we are modeling this uncertainty in the hardware system, as I've talked about, right? Using these techniques where, of course, this hardware system is our environment for this performance modeling particular system. But even moving forward, you know, as I talked about before with the approximate computing example, our hardware systems are just going to be increasingly less precise, right? And so here, you know, we see that with, again, this Jacobi iterative method where we saw, well, maybe if we recognize that we're actually fundamentally operating on a uncertain computing substrate and perhaps architect our software with that in mind, we can get performance benefits versus a replication strategy, right? So for me, when I see a diagram where I'm being pushed from above and being pushed from below with uncertainty coming in all these directions, I think it's meant to me that it was an inevitable that we're going to start thinking about how we apply these sorts of neural symbolic systems themselves that are starting to use uncertain components, things like large language models, to really tackle the fact that they're all trying to model uncertainty. We're modeling this type of uncertainty in our modern software, or where we're deploying our modern software systems. It's really a first order concern. And as we're seeing, it just can no longer be ignored. And I think, personally, there's a wide variety of different interesting research directions to take that we've been discovering. And I think that many people in the community have been working on as well. And I hope people are inspired perhaps today to go and think about some of these problems as well. But just as a simple preview of some of the things that we've been doing, for example, we've been thinking about what is a programming methodology? You know, we think of methodologies like declarative programming, or functional programming, or object-oriented programming. Like what are the types of programming methodologies that make sense in this new space? And one thing that we've had in the previous few years, inspired by what we've done in DIFF2, is actually surrogate programming, which is starting to outline techniques and tactics for thinking about building these types of surrogates, such as what we saw with DIFF2, right? And so, for example, the surrogate, just as we had talked about, the surrogate is going to be a neural network that's going to model the I/O behavior of some program, right? And what we've wanted to work towards is, can we start thinking of a theory of learning surrogates and maybe even associated program analysis that allows us to rate the program that we're trying to surrogatize for some definition to the problem that we're trying to, or to the model that we're trying to learn. And we've made initial progress towards this, right? Towards this theory of learning surrogates. So, you know, programs are just functions. There's nothing super special about that. And the literature, if you actually comb through the machine learning literature, you'll find, for example, rough sample complexity bounds on a neural network's ability to learn classes of functions. So correspondingly, there could be opportunities here to think about which classes of programs that neural networks can learn effectively if we're thinking about using surrogates as a primary programming tool, right? And so something that we've done over the past year or so has been using the intentional representations of the program. Since we can analyze a program and then use that to provide better learning bounds. So as a concretization here, if I want to learn a surrogate of this type of program where it has a branch in it, like this is a large program, inside it there's a branch, I can go left or I can go right, left to F and left to G, right? And what I want to do is, again, learn a surrogate here. But the question now is, to learn a surrogate is I need data. What data should I generate here? And clearly I need to generate data that's going to exercise both sides of these branches. Should I generate this uniformly? Should I have equal weight? Is there some sort of the input data distribution in which I'm going to deploy it? There are all sorts of strategies here, but this is going to be a fundamental question if you're trying to build a surrogate for a system. So what we found is that what we can do is actually do program analysis. We can try to use program analysis to reason about the complexity of the functions but below this branch, where, so for example, we have a nice linear function over here versus something much more wiggly, which is going to have higher complexity. What you'll find is, based on our analysis will tell you when you generate inputs, what you want to do is bias your examples more towards the complex programs, complex part of the program, rather than the simpler part of the program. Seems obvious in hindsight, but it's something where we can actually now start to build programming languages tools, program analysis tools that now automatically inform the way in which we are going to train these sorts of neural networks. And in preliminary results, where we apply this to a renderer, which is again, you know, if you take DiffTune, which is a physical simulator of hardware systems, this is going to be a physical simulator of essentially the dynamics of light. So we apply this to a renderer, and what we can see is we have our ground truth image here, and if we do a naive uniform sampling, which you might otherwise do, versus our guided sampling, right? Our guided sampling is going to give you a much higher quality result for the same number of examples. The last one I wanted to talk about is really more open challenges. I myself have had work in the space of reasoning. How can we actually reason now about the correctness of software systems built in these ways? But many people in the community have also as well. And so I put this here more as inspiration and to provoke discussion, which is, what does it mean for these systems to even be correct now? Where certainly we have traditional properties like safety. Does a program satisfy basic invariance, right? Does it always return a result that is greater than zero, right? It is a distance metric and always needs to do this. And if I do something strange, I approximate this program in some way, this is a basic property that needs to hold to the final property. Or it could be something even more intentional where I'm never going to reference a null pointer, right? These are classic types of invariance that we may want to be true of a piece of software. Well, in this concept of uncertainty, we really need to rethink these types of properties where now perhaps they're more probabilistic. Safety hold with some probability, right? Or are my results within epsilon of some idealized, right? I've had a history of results doing both of these things. Right? Now, there are also concepts like generalization. This starts to become new. I think we've only informally thought about this in some ways with our work in testing and even thinking about the difference between our dev environments and production. But fundamentally, what we're thinking about is a generalization problem, right? If I have one of these systems crafted in this way, it's been developed. Now it's been fundamentally developed with the data set that we've used during training of this system. Will this system generalize in production to a distribution of unseen inputs? Right? Now, also questions about robustness. Do systems behaviors change under slight perturbations of data? Right. Now, if I were to ever so slightly regenerate my data set, am I going to get an entirely different system with entirely different behaviors? Because that's not necessarily going to be the most comfortable idea in the world and thinking about how robust our system may be to, for example, replication. We need to build it again or if someone's trying to replicate the underlying system. Interpretability. Right? Can we actually understand and triage failures of these systems? What can we do? Now, there's been a wide variety of different results going on in the community of all sorts of adversarial verification of neural networks, thinking about reinforcement learning. How do you develop monitors and shields for reinforcement learning? I think a lot of this stuff is very interesting. And I think where the system or the community broadly should go is figuring out how you start to really connect these to some of the real problems people are trying to do in their day-to-day and constructing these types of software systems. Right? And my hope is that we'll be able to make strong progress here. And maybe what it requires us is to rethink how our systems behave a little bit differently. Because, for example, we go back to our Jacobi iterative method. So back in 2018, you know, we had this result and we demonstrated the benefits. The fact that we were only going to get 2.6% more overhead, but we also sat down and wrote some proofs, right? We actually realized that we actually bound the number of additional iterations that you may incur by using this type of strategy for this particular problem. And so essentially you have a delta T that's going to be some function of the epsilon that you're going to have, how big of an error you're going to have. And the reason why this worked is because these systems are self-stabilizing systems. So Jacobi is very interesting, where if you encounter one of these errors, so Jacobi will converge to the right answer, regardless from wherever you start in the space of guesses, initializations of the problem, right? It's always going to converge. So that's great. And so when you have an error, what happens is essentially you just restart, right? It's like you're restarting. Now, fortunately, the way these errors propagate through these systems is not catastrophic. So rather than restarting from a random point, the reason why we're converging much more quickly is because we're restarting from a point that has still preserved some of the information that we've made in these initial 10,000 iterations of progress. It's not truly a catastrophic failure, right? So starting to rethink our systems as perhaps more self-stabilizing systems, systems where we can bound the impacts of errors, the impacts of uncertainty may lead us towards new directions in thinking about software. So with that, I'm just going to wrap up. My personal opinion, landscape of software is just fundamentally changing. It's been changing. And I think it's finally here. I don't think you can deny the fact that virtually most programs are going to be written going forward are now going to be programmed using a large language model, which is generating code that who knows who understands. Right? And so, I mean, this is the future. Right? Again, future coming from below. New hardware substrates, future coming from above, deploying these systems in very rich, expressive, partially observable environments. And again, computations with these opaque machine learning systems. Now, the consequence of all of this is, again, that there's an epsilon. There's these epsilons along the way. We really, as a community, need to start thinking more carefully about epsilon correctness, probabilistic correctness, because these are the tools that we need to think about what these systems do. And it's not a way that at least as me as a classic computer scientist has been trained to really think about, you know, what our systems are doing. But I think there's an opportunity. If we make progress here, I think we'll get much more amazing, much more capable systems, but systems that we'll also still be able to understand. And so with that, I'm happy to take any questions in the QA.
Thank you so much, Mike. This was, you know, an amazing set of things for all of us to think about, and we have people in the Q&A. Thank you for your talk and things like that. I'll take the first question that came early in your presentation, and go ahead. Can you see the Q&A or I will be triaging and asking you the questions. Okay.
Yeah, go ahead. Let me see. I might be able to get there, but it might take a little time.
That's okay. That's okay. And so the work that you started, reminding us, the uncertainty comes from everywhere. And then you start to talk about those applications and the Jacobi iteration as one example of applications that have some tolerance for fault. That we had in the Q&A the comment that there was work on this direction of fault tolerance algorithm around 20 years back. Do you see this as an evolution of that direction of work? And I think that this may refer to the work in communities like supercomputing did, you know, they were, because they work so many with those models, right? Those numerical analysis, iterative models. So they have been looking at that. Do you think this is coming from the same perspective? Or how do you may relate to when people thought 20 years ago about fault tolerance algorithms?
Oh, no, absolutely. I do think this is coming from that same vein. The work that we had there in 2018 built on some of the observations that we're seeing in, so for example, systems like fault tolerant GEMRES that were going on. These were, again, systems that are coming from this intersection between, you know, the scientific computing, numerical analysts, mathematicians, right, as well as a high-performance HPC community of thinking about how we can build, you know, fault-tolerant solvers, right? And I think in that space, there's some very interesting results that came out. I'm not sure how broadly they've been adopted since, but I think my take on these is really, how do we move that to other parts of our stack, right? How do we think about fault tolerance, robustness for more traditional applications as well, where there's not necessarily quite a nice mathematical formalism? We all need to start somewhere. So I think that results, those results of those times are very interesting and impactful. And I think that's the open question is, can we generalize the observations there to other manners of software?
Thank you. Now a question on neural network correctness. So when you say that a neural net is correct with some probability, what does that even mean? It is often the case that if you give the same input, it will produce the same error. So the correctness probability is 0%. And I think that there is a wink wink here from our colleague on that. But what, you know, if you want to elaborate on what you mean about a neural net correctness with some probability.
So, yeah, so what is your event space? That's really the question, right? Are we talking about this probability is quantified over the distribution of inputs that I'm going to have passed into the system? Now, that's one way to think about this, because otherwise, yes, you're right. This is a deterministic, at least a neural network as constructed is deterministic. There are certainly other techniques for randomizing behaviors that you're going to have coming out of a neural network. And so that's another alternative way of instantiating this probability. Personally, so I have played games with all sorts of different styles of these types of bounds when we're doing the approximate computing work of, can we, for example, again, quantify, what are we quantifying over? That's always a fundamental question. Is it over outputs? When you look at some of the work with hardware reliability, sometimes what it is the stochasticity is going to be the hardware substrate itself, right? So it's subject to potential errors that we're going to have in the distribution over those errors. But we've also even looked at techniques of randomizing the algorithms themselves. And so that way, you're going to have a probability associated with that.
Okay. We have now a question that relates to, you know, a different domain in terms of uncertainty. So possibly another extreme way, for example, space shuttle control computers. In those systems, they would have a number, the guest here said, 5 independent computers, and they are configured to have this very high level of redundancy, computing the same thing, you know, the kind of thing that you mentioned as one way of doing that. And then there was another one computer that was completely independent computer written different group with different software, really meaning that it's not only replication, but there is another entity that was trying to compute the same thing. So the question would be in, you know, when you see your research, what do you see it to fit this domain, for example, flight computers, in computer-controlled aviation. So if lives are in the line, or if it is really a space where reliability is higher than average software, how do you see the space evolving regarding handling uncertainty? And I hope I made a reasonable presentation for
me. Yeah, so things like redundancy, I'm still core supportive of these. You know, some of the idea of doing approximation rather than redundancy is illustrative of instances where perhaps we can think differently, right? We don't necessarily always need redundancy. If lives are online, perhaps you don't want to do that. It's not something you want to do. You don't want to accept this at all. Now, having said that, there are other challenges thinking in this type of space. So there's a line of work that we've done, my student Eric Axenkin has done, what we called belief programming, which the idea and where we actually applied this was with the Mars Polar Lander. And so the Mars Polar Lander is an interesting case study. So their JPL actually did a report out of this lander, where what the lander, unfortunately, Mars Polar Lander crashed into the surface of Mars. And so what happened at an abstract view is the lander was coming close to the surface. It has a sensor system, a sensor and essentially detection system that's trying to detect whether or not it has landed on the surface. Unfortunately, several hundred feet above the surface, it believed it had actually touched the surface, even though it had not. And so it turned off its engines and therefore fell just into the surface. Now, if you look at that report, what's interesting there is what happened was there was a failure to account for the uncertainty in the sensing. So what happened is that the altimeter that they have, it's detecting the distance between the craft and the surface of the moon, could actually be influenced by deploying the landing gears, where essentially what you get are these false positives that you had landed. Now, in designing the system, this is something they knew that was a problem, or let's say a source of uncertainty in the sensor design. They had written essentially an analysis of how the system should operate, what should be done, how to account for the uncertainty, the fact that these false positives didn't happen. But in the software implementation, they actually implemented it incorrectly. And so this case wasn't handled appropriately. Now, in this line of work that we have, what we've done is we've come up with a way of a modeling language for someone to write down this sensor uncertainty, essentially saying, okay, this sensor to produce this altitude. However, if we deploy the landing gear, then it's possible that this sensor or this altitude reading has been corrupted, right? And so you can actually write this down essentially as a program. And then what we do is we have a system that can take this uncertainty model and actually dynamically track the uncertainty. It can tell you, is it possible, right, that there's an error with this sensor at this point in time, right? And if so, you can make a different decision. So what it does is actually automates some of the core work that they were attempting to do there in the software implementation, but had failed to implement correctly. And so when you think about uncertainty, at least at that safety critical level, I would say that there are multiple sources. Yes, there's the reliability issue, thinking about hardware reliability. There's also the natural reliability of being in a sensor-based environment. And in that environment, in many instances, there's a manual process for trying to manage that uncertainty. But we think that there's a rise of new languages, things like probabilistic programming. Like I said, belief programming is what we have talked about, which sort of has a similar concept of instead of tracking probabilities of events and states that you may be in, it's going to track sets. And then having systems that dynamically allow you to interrogate that uncertainty to then make decisions, right, without you needing to encode that sense of uncertainty yourself.
Well, that's quite interesting. And I think I'm going now to, you know, I'm not sure if I'm going to ask a question or give you a dump of my, you know, core reaction to this whole story. So, you know, so people who have debugged GCC errors that only appears when you have 1,000 cores or something like that, spend, you know, months trying to find this path that, of course, the designers didn't think about. So it was, you know, a corner case. So when I'm thinking now that, you know, my next project, I may decide to use a compiler from your group that is, you know, generated. I'm thinking now on this one, how we can explore a behavior and try to do that debugging that we did before, because we understood exactly line by line, we could try to follow the interpretability by doing tracing, mm-hmm. as you mentioned in your talk. So that part of problem determination becomes really hard. So when systems became really large, distributed systems explored, you would look at the top conferences in systems, OSTI, SOSP, and there were so many papers on helping people to find problems on those systems.
Yep.
It became right really hard. Now, when I look that if we do go, you know, surrogates as part of the methodology, I'm not even saying that I heard you that it will replace, but let's say that now me, software developer, developing a new file system, that I will have a piece that is a surrogate to capture some things, and it will have other things that may come from, you know, POSIX semantics or whatever, you know, legacy thing you need, and I'm going to marry. The hard part is that what is the story for problem determination? Who are the people who get the call that now there is this problem and it's really high and we need a SWAT team to fix and find it, how we're going to work on it? And I wonder if when you're thinking about the program methodology, you're thinking about that, about as you put pieces together, if there is some breadcrumbs or some traces that mm-hmm. you can give to help people to find the problems, because that may be really hard. Now, another part of it is that if you look at things like file systems, most files are small and die soon, right? So a lot of our file systems are inefficient if you go to the worst possible case scenario to guarantee correctness of file systems. But if in your very, you know, approach of us trying to find the distributions, the input data, you said that is a hard problem. Well, how you do those data sets in order to get to some notion of reliability, how that all fits together, since we may not see those corner cases very common. So the reliability, I'm repeating your last slide, just saying that I think this reliability in this story will be a big challenge, Mike. So and you probably have more answers about, you know, you probably don't see as many obstacles as I see right now.
No, I see lots of obstacles, right? I, as you pointed out on the DiffTune side, you know, this was part of our inspiration. Like, how can we make this interpretable? Like, how can we still use the power of data, but give a description that essentially fully interpretable? So the output of DiffTune is just a tuned version of LLVM MCA, where you can interrogate still essentially all the decisions that are being made, right? So the final output is not something where you need to understand what a neural network is doing. Right now, more broadly than that, it's going to be a fundamentally interesting future, I have to say. I think the forces of software developing are moving in a direction where to access new capabilities, these types of perhaps naturally uninterpretable components are going to be integrated, right? So I think the challenges you're outlining are ones that we have to face and be prepared to face, right? And think of ways of enabling people to use this type of technology in ways that overall give a good understanding of the system, right? So it's, I think these are all—
You sound hopeful.
I don't know if I'm hopeful. I think it's unavoidable, right? I think the power of these tools put in people's hands are such that they can do things that they couldn't do before. And so they will do that. Mm-hmm. And so that's where we're going to end up. And so what comment are we going to make? We can tell people not to do it, but I don't think that's really going to help us.
In your talk, that's a question here. There was an example of a program that was mixing code and English, you know, saying that this is, you know, a way of doing becoming a common way of developing software. And I think you showed an example, but it went fast to read. So you want to tell us more about an example of a programs people are coding now where they have really just natural language as a piece of it.
So there was an example that I was seeing where someone was trying to write, there are a few things. So one example is actually a student of mine who was working on a search, essentially a semantic search, a semantic abstract search of archive. So he's got this program that's largely, okay, there are a couple keywords that I want to put together. And here is suddenly this prompt that's a prompt out to this large language model that says that I want you to, you know, search for a whole bunch of papers that, let's say, have synonyms of all these words that I have here, and then bring those back to me, right? So synonyms of this word, where, you know, word is something that's been written. This is something that's, you know, come in as input, but synonyms of is an algorithm that is now being interpreted by a large language model, right? And we just short of encoding all possible synonyms, right, of the words that we have and expect as inputs, this is not something that's going to be programmed manually, but can be written in English, given an intuitive understanding, and can be interpreted by a large language model to then go and retrieve results that are related to that, right? And so these are the types of computations I think are, in the short term, being integrated, where we can give natural language specifications to what they do, but the programming implementation is, I mean, it's, I guess you can go and try to develop a massive thesaurus and do this, or perhaps there's an available thesaurus that's out there, right? But this can just be done automatically, right?
Yeah, that's okay, that's reasonable. Okay, I think we don't have more questions for the NSF people. We'll be talking to Mike again at 3 p.m. Eastern for a little bit if we have, people want to discuss more. But thank you so much. Thank you for people who attended.